spending more time indoors in fall and winter might be appealing and cozy, but it can also be an effective way for respiratory viruses to spread. Alaska has seen spikes in respiratory illness in recent weeks. What do you need to know about the latest viral variants, their treatment, and the vaccines that can prevent infection or lessen severity if you do get sick? Alaska's top medical experts are on hand to describe the latest science about viral disease, how to prevent it, and answer your questions today on Talk of Alaska. From Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. What's driving the increase in respiratory illness right now? Pertussis, known as whooping cough, has spiked higher than at any time in the last 8 years in Alaska. The State Health Department reports there have been more than 130 cases so far this year, compared to 26 cases in all of 2023. RSV is another respiratory illness that can affect young and old, and affects Alaska Native children at higher numbers. Cold and flu variants are an annual concern, and the COVID-19 virus is still mutating, with cases increasing during the summer and into fall. So, what's the latest information related to identifying and treating these viruses? How effective are the new vaccines, and when should you get them for yourself and your family? We're fortunate to have three of the lead Alaska medical professionals on hand today to answer these questions. Dr. Joe McLaughlin is the state epidemiologist with the Alaska Department of Health. Dr. Robert Lawrence is the chief medical officer with the state of Alaska. And Sarah Aho is the immunization program manager for the Alaska Department of Health. Welcome, all of you. Thanks so much for being in the studio.
Good morning, Lori.
Thank you, Lori.
It's great to have you all here. Before we start discussing the current viruses of concern, quickly help us understand how your jobs differ and help support each other. Dr. Lawrence, describe your work and role as Alaska's chief medical officer. You took over from Dr. Ann Zink.
That's right, just recently. First of all, let me say thank you, Lori, for bringing this important conversation to Alaska and allowing us to sit and be a part of the conversation today. You are correct. 4 months ago, I received a very heavy baton from our previous chief medical officer, Dr. Ann Zink, who was such an amazing leader in our state through a pandemic, and have taken the baton from her. My role will be similar to hers, although we don't know what's over the horizon. It's not that there's a new threat or a new pandemic that we're preparing for, but my job remains the same, and that is to keep an eye on what is it that our healthcare professionals need throughout the state, and what is it that the people of Alaska, what is it that they need to make sure that we're guarding the health, the well-being, and the self-sufficiency of all of our communities. And so my job is to make sure that the people who are in charge of keeping an eye on the health of Alaskans have what they need to do their job and to do it well.
So you're sort of forward-looking about what are the emerging concerns and how do we prepare for those?
That's right. Yeah, I would say it's on both fronts. So one of my jobs is to keep an eye on what is over the horizon. The other job is really to keep an eye on all of the amazing work that I am learning is being done in the corners, in the shadows of our communities by amazing people who are keeping an eye on the different determinants of health, the things that lead to either good health or threaten our health. And so over the last 4 months, it seems like in every new division that I learn about and getting to sit with the people throughout Alaska whose job it is to work, you know, within the Department of Health or various sections within our Department of Health, I'm just amazed at the work that for years has been done behind the scenes. And I end every single one of those meetings with this compelling need to say thank you, because until that moment, I didn't realize how many people behind the scenes were watching my back and taking care of my family and my community. And so part of my job is to make sure that those programs are supported and can go on, and make sure that there's always a clinical voice in the conversations, especially when it comes to policy making and trying to support the work that's being done. Making sure there's a doctor in the room who understands what it's like to be at the bedside, who understands from the patient's side what does it mean to navigate our very complex healthcare system, and make sure that our policies don't get in the way of actually getting people the health care that they need.
I'm happy to hear a positive tone, because I know there's been a lot of anxiety, about people leaving the medical field. So to hear from you that there are people still at it, still doing that very, very important work for on behalf of all of us is good to hear.
Oh, yes. And if you have the opportunity to do so, and you know of one of those people, to write a thank you note, to send a gift, to give a call. Even yesterday, we were working on a slide to describe what it was like to go through the pandemic as a healthcare professional and trying to decide what's the best word to describe what that was like. And the word that we landed on the end was the word weary. It was more than just being tired, more than just being fatigued or stretched. It really was this feeling of weary. But what came out of that was an amazing focus on what drives people to go into healthcare in the beginning. And it's a reminder that we take care of the most valuable resource in Alaska, which is people. And there's something about that that gets you through the weary period. And then I like your word hope, allows you to get up the next day and say, wow, we still have a lot of work to do, but the work is meaningful.
And let's go to work.
And it's worth the effort. Put me in, coach. Yeah, there's work to do.
Well, thank you, Dr. Lawrence, for starting us off. Dr. McLaughlin, talk about how your work in epidemiology helps inform what's needed for understanding and treating diseases and illnesses.
Sure. Well, Lori, it's a pleasure to be with you again. It's been a little while, and it's great to see you. You know, Dr. Lawrence's purview is really over the entire division of public health. And my focus is primarily in four areas, but not exclusively. So the four areas that I oversee are infectious diseases, and then HIV-STD, which is a different program, immunizations, and environmental public health. And so in the section of epidemiology, we monitor trends over time, and we look at specific diseases. There are about 50 reportable conditions in Alaska that we monitor over time. And then there are environmental concerns and other concerns that come up that we will respond to as well as, you know, for example, novel drugs of abuse. And then if there is an increase in, let's say, cases of pertussis, we will respond to that increase, and we will try to get the word out, let people know that this is happening. If there's a foodborne outbreak, we'll try and figure out which food it was that was causing the outbreak to occur, and we'll remove that food from the food source until things are cleaned up. And then we report out, and we report out through a few different mechanisms. One is we have a website. Number two, we do publish epidemiology bulletins. And I'm sure many of your listeners have seen those bulletins over the years. We've been circulating those since the 1970s. And we have public health alerts. And we also do direct outreach with the media. I do a lot of interviews with different reporters. And that's a fun part of my job. I find reporters to be such an excellent resource, and you guys are all, you're educators, and I just really appreciate the collaboration that we have with our reporter colleagues. So those are kind of the big things that I do in my job, and, you know, my section has, I don't know what it is at now, maybe 70 people or something in it that that do all of this work. But then there are issues in chronic disease and in women, children, family health and other areas that I might get involved with as well.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And Sarah, talk about your duties in the role of immunization program manager. Are you helping to secure the annual vaccine supply for Alaska, or what does this involve?
Yes, so I'm lucky enough to work with a really wonderful team here in Anchorage, and I'm within the section of epidemiology, work closely with Joe, and we do a variety of things, but really we are all vaccines all the time. So Drs. McLaughlin and Dr. Lawrence have a much broader purview, and really my focus is vaccines in Alaska, and that ranges from ensuring supply, as you said, staying up to date on what's coming up, what new vaccines are coming down the pipeline, and making sure Alaskans have the information and access to those vaccines. We also work with a network of vaccine providers throughout the state. We have over 150 providers who receive vaccines through state programs. And we want to make sure that those vaccines are well accounted for, well documented, and that Alaskans know where to find them.
All right. Thanks so much for getting us started here. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. And today we're talking about the season of viruses and what the latest information is on when vaccines will be available for this fall's series of COVID vaccines and flu. And we have in the studio with us today Dr. Robert Lawrence, who is the Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska, Dr. Joe McLaughlin, who is the State Epidemiologist for the Alaska Department of Health, and Sarah Aho, who is the Immunization Program Manager for the Alaska Department of Health. All right, let's dive in. Dr. McLaughlin, let's start with pertussis, since it's making headlines right now. It's at an eight-year high. The Anchorage School District is dealing with cases or potential cases at least six schools. What is pertussis, and how concerned are you about this outbreak? I know it's also called whooping cough. That's what a lot of people know it as.
That's right, Lori. Yeah, thank you so much. So pertussis is called whooping cough. It is a respiratory infection that can affect people of any age. The people who are at highest risk for more severe consequences are young children, particularly infants, as well as older adults, and then anybody who's immunocompromised. I'll let Dr. Lawrence go ahead and talk about sort of clinically what it looks like, but I can tell you what's happening right now in Alaska. We have updated numbers for you. We're actually at 234 cases of reported pertussis as of last Friday. And just for context, we had 149 cases reported in 2016, and that was the previous highest year in the past 8 years for pertussis cases. So we're really looking at a pretty sizable epidemic of pertussis happening right now.
Is it just in South Central, or is this statewide, these numbers?
It is statewide. You know, the numbers were highest in July, and by far the region that had the highest number in July was the Mat-Su region. And in August, the Mat-Su numbers came down considerably, but then the Anchorage numbers started to come up. We are seeing a general sort of slight decline in the numbers, but all regions have been affected. And what happens with pertussis is we tend to see a cyclical epidemic that occurs in the United States about every 3 to 5 years. And the reason for this cyclical epidemic is, number one, waning immunity. And we have two effective vaccines, and we'll let Sarah talk about those vaccines, but we have two effective vaccines, one for children and one for adults, to protect against pertussis. Those vaccines are highly effective shortly after you get fully vaccinated, but then you do see significant waning over time, over the years. The other thing is, every year there are new children born, and those children are going to get up to speed with their vaccination. Some children, unfortunately, are not vaccinated. But that new cohort of the population that comes in every year is at high risk, and that also helps drive these cyclical epidemics. When we get a sufficient number of the newer kids that haven't been exposed to the bacteria, then we'll see an increase in the number of cases.
Dr. Lawrence, what should parents look for if their kids are getting sick? What are some symptoms that they should be watching for pertussis?
You know, I trained as a family practice physician, still board certified in family medicine, so it's hard for me not to see the respiratory season through any other lens than, small town family doctor. And we always thought of this respiratory season the same way you might think of a sports season. And our primary team rivalry every year were these respiratory diseases and viruses that would circulate. When we think of that rival team, we usually think that of three star players. They're always there every year. The new addition to that, of course, is COVID, mm-hmm. but there were also influenza and then respiratory syncytial virus, or that's too hard to say, so we say RSV. But those are like the three star players. What we find this year is this introduction of a fourth sort of surprise player, which is pertussis, mm-hmm. Which causes the whooping cough. And so the thing that makes it like the other illnesses that just show up at this period of time is that the onset is fairly sudden, but it always begins with a runny nose, small cough, maybe a low-grade fever. But there's not a way to distinguish those symptoms from those other players, even other players on the team, that are circulating at this time. What makes pertussis different that parents should pay attention to? Is it after that early stage of kind of the runny nose, the cough, a little bit of irritability, is sudden trouble with breathing? Mm. And so the reason we call this whooping cough is that, especially in kids, after that early stage of what seems like any other cough and cold, we enter a stage of coughing. And that coughing stage can become what we call paroxysmal, or it's just this sudden onset of a series of coughs that's just cough, 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 and you can't even take a breath in. And so you can imagine coughing like that. And at the moment, you just need to take a breath. You try to pull in as much air as you can. And in those young ones, that little airway is so small that it sounds somewhat musical when they take the breath in. And that's why we call this whooping cough.
You say musical, I say terrifying.
Well,
that sounds like a scary sound.
That's a great way to say that. And for parents, it is. It is very concerning because, as Dr. McLaughlin says, I think our real concern is when this is circulating in the community, the burden that that has on our young ones, especially those who are in the first year of life. In adults, we will get similar symptoms. We may have a runny nose, eyes that seem inflamed, a little bit of a headache, a little bit of fatigue, and maybe get a little bit of a cough. But in those young ones, it can cause such heavy respiratory disease and such a burden. And you're correct to use the word scary, because about one out of every three kids who in that first year of life, about one out of every three will end up needing hospitalization in order to take care of the respiratory issues that come from this. So what parents should pay attention to is that shift from the same symptoms as every other virus to problems with breathing. But it doesn't mean you have to wait till that moment to take someone in for care. We now have the ability, in fact, if you think of this as a sporting event, we actually have equipment now that we just haven't had for years. Going into this season, we do have hope, because there is the ability to immunize people against pertussis. We have vaccines for the other respiratory diseases, and we'll get to talk about that in a minute, I think, as well. But it's important at the early signs of illness, especially in that first year of life, to bring that to your physician's attention and make sure that the child is checked, because we can test and see if the cause is pertussis, and if so, we can treat that.
Right, it's tiny little airways. We want to make sure that they're treated quickly, because problems can, as you well know, can ramp up quite quickly when somebody's so small. Dr. McLaughlin, you wanted to add something there?
Yeah, and Lori, just for context, I want to give you all a sense for the numbers. So I mentioned that we've had 234 cases as of Friday. 164 of those cases were in children less than 15 years of age. So that's 70% of the cases. And then 29 or 12% were in infants. Mm-hmm. Now, of those 29 infants, 45% have been hospitalized. So that just provides some context. And Dr. Lawrence referenced that one-third in Alaska so far of the 29 infants that have been diagnosed, 45% have been hospitalized.
Nearly half. That seems like quite a high number. How does that compare to past? Does this particular strain seem more aggressive, or?
Well, the national estimate is you just kind of count on about a third of infants who get RSV will get hospitalized. The reason why our number is a little higher this year is uncertain. These are small numbers, so you have to take that into context. But also, probably not all of the RSV infections that have occurred in infants have been diagnosed and reported.
Mm. So, Sarah, I want to turn to you now. You know, it's a bit bewildering. Why is this outbreak happening now? Isn't pertussis vaccine required to attend school in Alaska?
It is required, but of course, children can receive this vaccine before they are school aged. So we can see this in schools. Not all children are vaccinated, and not everyone is up to date. We saw a big drop in routine vaccines for children during the COVID pandemic. People weren't going to as many well child visits and didn't have the chance to get up to date. And we have seen our rates improving over the last couple years, but this is a reminder that these diseases we see more of when less people are up to date on all of their routine vaccines. And so thinking about these vaccines to protect against pertussis. There are two, as Dr. McLaughlin mentioned. One is the DTaP vaccine for children that protects against diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. So it's a 3-for-1, which is great. And children at 2, 4, and 6 months, and then 15 to 18 months, each get a dose. So children get 4 doses when they're quite young. And then they get a booster when they're 4 to 6 years old. So right when they're going into kindergarten, they can get that booster. And it's highly effective for pertussis. It's about 98% effective for kids following that last dose at 15 to 18 months old. But then that protection does wane over time, which is why they get that booster at 4 to 6 years old. And then we have the Tdap vaccine for adolescents and adults, and that's recommended for all adolescents when they are about 11 to 12 years old, and then a booster shot for adults every 10 years. And one other important population that can receive this vaccine is pregnant people. So this is recommended during each pregnancy in that third trimester to protect those infants when they're born.
All right, let's go to the phones for a moment and hear from Susan in Bethel. Hi, Susan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for this topic. I think it's really important to get vaccinated. Last fall, I did a whole series of different ones, flu, shingles, COVID, RSV, and I spaced them out in case any of them made me sick. None of them did. Anyway, springtime, beginning of summer, I saw these full-page ads, 65 and older are immunocompromised to go ahead and get the COVID vaccine again. You know, it said if you haven't had one for 4 months and you're 65 and older, and these were full-page statewide ads and in the local paper and all that. So I went and we had a couple providers in Bethel. None of them had the vaccine. I said, well, I got an upcoming trip to Anchorage. I'll just do it then. And this is about midsummer by then. And I go over there. They don't have it available either. No, it was about June I went down there. They didn't have it available either. I checked 2 places. After that, I just said, well, maybe it's just not in the state. Yet here are these full-page ads. That's a lot of money to advertise statewide. Time to go get the vaccine. And then it's just not available. And that's so frustrating. And when I got back to Bethel, I checked with a couple of my other friends. They had the same frustration. So I'm just going to leave that out to you as if a vaccine is not available, yet there's ads all over statewide saying go ahead and get it, that's kind of frustrating. So I'll just leave it with that and see what your response is. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan, for the call. And I'm sure Sarah can give us an update right now about when vaccines will be available, hopefully both in urban areas, but also out to places like Bethel, and so critical to get out to rural Alaska.
Yeah, thank you so much for your call and for your question. That sounds really frustrating, and I'm sorry to hear that that was your experience and that that's how that worked out. As we went into the end of the COVID season, or coming up on a lot of expiration dates for those vaccines, we did see limited numbers in the state over the summer for the vaccine. And I'm happy to say that now we are coming up with a new COVID vaccine for this 2024-2025 season, respiratory season that we're talking about today. And those vaccines are starting to ship into the state now. So we'll start to see some this week and next week and more as time progresses. Those often come into pharmacies first and then to your local healthcare provider clinics, public health centers, and other clinics soon after that. So I'm sorry to hear that you couldn't get your update in the summer. But I guess the flip side of that and good news is that this fall vaccine for COVID will protect better against currently circulating strains.
Is this the normal time of year that the new vaccines come out? Is it later, earlier? How does it compare to past years?
You know, we don't really have a normal time quite yet for COVID vaccines. As we all know, there have been a lot of changes and changes in recommendations and guidelines. And what we're seeing from CDC is trying to make this more of an annual and predictable cycle with vaccine distribution. So last fall, this is about when vaccines were available for the 2023, 2024 COVID vaccine. And this is pretty similar to what we saw last year. And then this aligns somewhat with flu vaccine, which typically comes out in late August or early September.
All right. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about knowing what viruses of concern are circulating this fall and where and when and how you can get vaccinated against them as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We have in the studio with us today Dr. Robert Lawrence, who is the Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska, Dr. Joe McLaughlin, the State Epidemiologist at the Alaska Department of Health, and Sarah Aho, who is the Immunization Program Manager for the Department of Health. So let's talk about RSV, COVID, the flu. These are all concerns for this fall. Dr. McLaughlin, give us a quick overview of these illnesses, and we'll just kind of drill down individually from there.
Sure. So as we mentioned earlier, pertussis is currently in an epidemic proportion in Alaska and the United States. The other of these four bugs that we're talking about that is currently in epidemic proportion is COVID-19. So we are experiencing in the United States a summer wave of COVID-19, and that's affecting Alaska as well. It's being primarily driven by new variants that have mutations that result in increased transmissibility and immune evasion capabilities. And that's really what happened, that we've seen that throughout the pandemic. And then since the end of the pandemic, we get these new variants that are just a little bit different than the previous strains that have been circulating. They're able to evade that immunity and cause waves. And so that's what's happening right now. The four main variants that are circulating right now are called KP2.3, KP3, KP3.1.1, and LB1. And these are all Omicron variants. Mm. And they're the so-called flirt variants. Now, fortunately, as Sarah mentioned, the new vaccine that's going to be available by the end of this week and into next week in Alaska covers one of those strains, and it's the KP2 strain. And so these are all sort of slight variations on that theme. So this vaccine will be more effective at preventing disease in people who get exposed to these particular strains. And so that's what's happening right now with COVID. Now, with influenza and RSV, we typically don't start to see increases in influenza and RSV activity until the fall or early winter. And so right now, fortunately, those are all occurring at very, very low levels in Alaska.
The COVID variants that are circulating right now, are they, you know, as you mentioned, they keep mutating, so they're able to end run the, speaking of sports metaphors,
right,
end run the vaccine. But are the variants less fatal than when the pandemic first started? And they're, you know, of course, before vaccines. But are the waves now less serious than during the main thrust of the pandemic?
The short answer is yes. So we are seeing lower hospitalization rates as well as lower death rates associated with these new variants. Now, that being said, we are still seeing quite a few hospitalizations and deaths across the nation. Our hospitalization rate on the monthly level as of this past August was 18 hospitalizations per 100,000 population in the United States. That was in August. And then the death rate was 2 deaths per 100,000 population over the past 3 months. So it is fortunate that we are seeing a decrease in hospitalization and death rates, but it's important for people to know that people are still getting hospitalized and still dying from COVID. And so by far and away, the best way to prevent severe COVID disease is to get vaccinated.
And if folks who are hesitant about vaccines think, oh, well, it's not as fatal as it used to be, so maybe I don't have to worry so much. Is there a case to be made for, you know, who knows what the next variant may involve, and it could be, is it that it could be much more virulent and more fatal? Is that possible? And so getting vaccinated is just a way to help prevent even more serious waves of the virus?
Maybe I can start with that one. The answer is yes. So we do have some pretty good data on vaccine efficacy for the COVID vaccine. So this is pooled vaccine efficacy data. And now starting with adolescents and adults, the vaccine this past year protected about 43% of adolescents and adults from medically attended COVID infection, about 44% of COVID hospitalizations, and about 23% of COVID deaths. And in infants and children, at least one study showed that it had about an 80% efficacy in preventing medically attended COVID. Mm. Now, there are large confidence intervals on these estimates because, you know, it's difficult to do these studies, but that gives you a sense for how effective these vaccines are. And if we were to see a novel strain, another new variant of COVID that has a lot of mutations that results in a more severe wave, I would guess that there's a likelihood that the current vaccine that's coming out this year will help protect against that strain to some degree. The other thing I want to point out is that there are a lot of good studies that have shown that if you're up to date on your COVID boosters, that decreases your risk of getting long COVID if you do get infected with COVID. And that's really an important thing to point out as well.
Yes, Dr. Lawrence, please.
Yeah, I was just going to, if I could, take out a highlighter and put it over there because you hear that data, which is very compelling. And it's important to remember that, you know, medicine is a scientific endeavor, but at its heart, it is based on something that science can't really touch or describe or understand, and that's trust. It's being able to look at that data and then make a decision. But usually we make our decision based on whether or not we trust the person who's providing that to us or the recommendation. And when it comes to kind of those questions about should I get a vaccine or not, really what a person is asking is, can I trust this? And the important message in all of that data is that vaccines are much like washing our hands. It's good for us personally, but it's also good for others around us. If I'm preparing a meal, you would want to know that I washed my hands for me, but also for those who are receiving that meal. And the same is true of vaccines, that it is protective for the individual who gets the vaccine. To me, the most compelling thing right now is the prevention of long COVID in really just about everybody who gets the vaccine. But also for those who are at higher risk, the elderly, the young, those who are immunocompromised, there's a strong case to be made. And I think the data clearly shows that being up to date with the newest vaccine is what is going to be helpful at preventing future hospitalizations and deaths. So vaccines are much like a software update for your body. And so as the virus changes over time, you need to download the software update. And in this case, it would be the COVID vaccine.
Yes, literally preventing viruses.
to reverse a metaphor that we use every day.
Yeah. Such an important point about long COVID. I know someone who has long COVID. It has been transformative in not a good way for their life. They are unable to work as much as they were at one point in time. And it's just very concerning. So Sarah, you talked a little earlier before the break about COVID vaccines starting to arrive now in the state. What about the other vaccines for RSV, for the flu? What's the status of the other annual updates, the downloads that everyone needs to get the vaccines? Where are they and where can people get them?
Yes, so flu vaccines are also being shipped to the state this week and next week. So we've already been seeing quite a bit of flu vaccine in the state. So that's pretty widely available and getting more so as the days go on. As I mentioned, COVID vaccines are starting to ship into the state this week. So in the next week or two, we'll see those widely available as well. The vaccines available for pertussis, so Tdap and Dtap, are already widely available at most healthcare providers' offices who offer vaccinations. And then we haven't talked about RSV very much yet, but RSV vaccines for adults are widely available now. And we have an immunization called nirsevimab for infants, and that can start to be administered in October. So that has an October start date for infants.
So we have an email question from Chris, who says, hi, is the RSV vaccine annual, and should I get all vaccines at the same time, COVID, flu, RSV, etc.? Thanks, Chris.
So for adults, the RSV vaccine is a one-time deal. So if Chris or anyone else has received that RSV vaccine last fall, they do not need to get another dose, which is great. The CDC and ACIP keep a close eye on effectiveness and longevity. And right now for adults, the recommendation is just one time. So that's good news. And all of these vaccines can be co-administered. That means you can get them all at the same time.
Why do some vaccines need to be annually updated and some it's one and done?
Well, as Joe was talking about some of these strains with COVID, these strains change fairly quickly, and that's also true with flu. So every year, the FDA makes a recommendation for what those vaccines should specifically protect against. So right now, the COVID vaccine is protecting against that KP2 strain, and flu vaccine is protecting against three different strains that were seen quite a bit in the southern hemisphere during their flu season. So we get a good preview on what we think will happen with flu season and COVID season based on what's happening now. So those vaccines are changed every year to match what we expect to see in communities.
But RSV is sort of like Windows 1.0 and you just don't need to.
That's
it doesn't update
for now. Yep.
It doesn't update, okay.
Yeah.
You know,
another thing is that it also depends on what part of the virus or the bacteria the vaccine targets. And so if it targets a part of the virus or the bacteria that's constantly changing, then you're going to have to update those vaccines frequently. But if it targets a part of the virus or the bacteria that is really stable and doesn't change over time, like the measles virus, you're pretty much done after you get fully vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lawrence.
I might just add, this is a good time to introduce, if I were in a community and I'm hearing all of these different vaccines are available and wondering which ones do I get annually, which ones are every 5 years, every 10 years, and some of them just once in a lifetime. How do I keep track of all of that? Yeah. There is a tool available in the state, which is called Docket. And we like to say, put Docket in your pocket. I'm showing everyone my cell phone because on there I have the app, which is called Docket. And with that, I can pull up my immunization schedule and actually look at which of these vaccines am I due for now, which ones have I had in the past. And so it's such a helpful tool in keeping track of what's helpful. And you can do this for yourself, for your family, for your children. You can have that information. And that's a tool that's widely available and I would say very helpful for you and also for your healthcare providers when they ask the question, are you due for this or that vaccine?
Yeah, that's thank you so much for letting people know about it. Again, the app is called Docket. You can download it and put all your information in there with your vaccination history. Dr. Lawrence, in an earlier interview, you talked about the distinctions between protections that are gained from antibiotics versus vaccines. Help people understand that.
Yeah, that's such a great question because vaccines are very different than other medicines that we use. Typically, if I get sick and I give an antibiotic, that medication only works for a few hours or a day. And so if you came in and had a bacterial infection, in fact, pertussis is a great example. If we are treating that with an antibiotic, that medication only lasts for the amount of time that it's in your body. And so if I give you an injection, it only lasts for the day. But a vaccine is very different. A vaccine can last for, as we've just talked about, a year, in some cases 5 years, in some cases 10 years. There are some vaccines that provide lifelong immunity, and that's because the vaccine is really, maybe to use another metaphor, it's like teaching your body to study for a test that is coming down the road. In fact, a lot of people might wonder, why would I get an injection of a medicine now when I'm not sick in anticipation of sometime down the road when I might get sick? But for thousands of years, 2,000 years, we've learned that if you expose a person to a non-deadly form of an illness, in this case a vaccine that is not harmful, that when you meet the real virus, you're able to meet that virus without it causing harm or hospitalizations or leading to death. So in a sense, that's kind of like if you were studying for a big test coming up, and imagine the teacher handing you all the answers to the test beforehand. You would appreciate that and you would ace the test. And in the same way, getting the vaccine is a way of teaching your body to prepare for really what is a tough test when you meet the real COVID virus, the real flu virus. When you meet, your body's already studied up, so you're able to pass the test, you ace the test, and more importantly, you don't pass it on to others.
How do antibiotics help in a virus setting, though? Because aren't antibiotics more aimed at bacterial infections?
Oh, that's a great question. We actually have antibiotics are not only for bacteria, but we also have forms that are antiviral. And so there are medications that specifically target either slowing down or eradicating viruses, like the flu virus or like the COVID virus. We actually have vaccines that are specifically designed to inactivate that particular virus, again, so that your body has time to turn on its immune system, run the security software, and get rid of the virus. And so just as we have antibiotics, which most of us would be familiar with, things like penicillin, mm-hmm. we also have antivirals, which are things like Paxlovid, you've heard of for COVID, or
right.
also Tamivir that we use for flu. So.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the annual flu and COVID virus season and how you can keep yourself safe as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We did have a question by email from Larry who asks, can you please explain what long COVID is? Dr.
Sure.
McLaughlin?
Sure, I can start with that. So long COVID is a serious illness, potentially serious, that can result in chronic conditions requiring a lot of medical care. Long COVID can include a wide range of ongoing symptoms and conditions that can last for weeks and months, and in some cases, even years. Anybody who's had the SARS-CoV-2 virus infection can experience long COVID, including children. And COVID-19 vaccination, as we mentioned before, is the best available tool to prevent long COVID. Living with long COVID can be difficult and isolating, especially when there are no immediate answers or solutions. Unfortunately, we all probably have some knowledge of at least one or two people who have been suffering from long COVID for months to even years, and it can be quite debilitating. In some cases, people need to stop working and really have a difficult time even getting out of bed.
Mm. All right, thank you for that. Let's talk about some of the other viruses of concern. Diphtheria, it always sounds to me like a long ago virus, but it is still active. How much is it still circulating, and how severe is the illness?
Well, Dr. maybe Lawrence? I'll just start
yes,
by clarifying that diphtheria is actually a bacteria, as is
it's not a
pertussis,
virus.
As is tetanus. So all three of those that are included in the vaccine are different bacteria that still are circulating.
Oh, and so and is that why all three of them, it seems odd that the three are combined. I know I always think of tetanus. I stepped on a, you know, the classic case. I stepped on a rusty nail, and I thought, wait a minute, when was the last time I had a tetanus? So I rushed in and got a booster.
No, and that's a great way to think about that, because like you, growing up, it seems like, you know, I always got my tetanus shot every 10 years because of that fear of stepping on the rusty nail. And tetanus is a very scary, debilitating problem where a person's muscles just lock up, and it's terribly painful and so hard to watch. And we've largely prevented that in Alaska, but it still circulates. We still have cases. Diphtheria, we're famous in Alaska because diphtheria is what led to the big serum run. You remember 100 years ago when, to rescue the people of Nome, the anti-serum was taken to treat a diphtheria outbreak. But diphtheria still shows up, not in huge numbers like we're seeing with the other waves, but it's still present in Alaska and from time to time will show up. Again, the vaccines are what help keep that at bay. And pretty much because the vaccine lasts a long time for, let's say, that one bacteria, diphtheria, then we get a little longer protection there, maybe a little less with tetanus and even shorter right now for pertussis. But I think the important point is that they're all bacteria, but in the vaccine are not the actual bacteria. And I want to clarify that. The vaccine is made up of just components off of the bacteria so that your body learns to recognize, as Dr. McLaughlin said, certain components of that bug, so that when your body meets the real one, it knows exactly how to respond and eliminate that from your body.
But the vaccination itself is not the live virus. You don't have any risk of getting it.
That's right. It's more like, as I was saying, it's more like giving you the answers to the test. Like, this is what to look for. So when this actual bacteria shows up, your body knows exactly how to respond. And in most cases, you won't even know that you were exposed.
The only time you should cheat.
Well, and it's not cheating. Yeah, that's important to say. Yeah.
Unfortunately, the vaccine is so effective against diphtheria, we see very few cases in the United States anymore. In fact, most, if not all, the cases, I would say the vast majority, are associated with international travel.
Mm. Sarah, what are the trends in vaccination rates for adults and especially children? Both, what are you seeing in Alaska and the nation? There's been a lot of back and forth about whether or not people trust things, especially since the pandemic. What are you seeing in those rates?
I mentioned earlier that we saw quite a dip in childhood vaccines during the pandemic. And I think that was really largely because people didn't go anywhere for about a year and we were in lockdown. And a lot of those kiddos weren't going to their regular well child checkups, which is typically where they received their vaccinations. We've seen an increase for kids in trends, but we're still not back to pre-pandemic levels. You know, we're just below 70% for those youngest kids. Those kindergarten age children are a little bit low as well. So we're about 60% for kindergarten age children. We've actually seen an increase in some adult vaccines lately, which I think is really exciting and really positive. Our Tdap rates have been increasing, and again, that has that pertussis component to protect against pertussis. And then our flu vaccine rates have been fairly low for the last couple of years, and we know flu vaccine and COVID vaccine are really great ways to help protect against those diseases. So I'd encourage everyone to consider that for this fall, and again, to check in with that Docket app if they're unsure if they're due for a vaccine, and especially if they're unsure if their children are due for a vaccine.
We had an email question from Caroline saying, I had COVID beginning of July. I was fully vaccinated. When should I get an updated COVID vaccine now? Sarah?
Sure. The recommendation is to wait at least 4 months. Okay. I also recently had COVID and considering when to get that. And I think, you know, thinking about that 4 to 6 month time frame, I'm probably going to aim for about Christmas just to give a little holiday boost.
All right. We only have a few minutes left here, and I wanted to get a question in about H5N1. Dr. McLaughlin and Dr. Lawrence, the CDC reports that avian flu, known as H5N1, has spread from birds to cattle, and the virus was detected in a person in Missouri. This is the 14th human case of H5 reported during 2024 in the U.S., the first case of H5 without a known occupational exposure to sick or infected animals. The CDC says the risk to the general public remains low, but what are your thoughts about the level of concern here for Alaska?
Yeah. Well, let me just begin by the overall message, and that is, as you said, CDC's comment is correct, that right now there is not a rise in cases of public concern, but that should not be interpreted as we're not paying attention. There is recognition that any time a pathogen moves from an animal population, transmits into humans, and especially when we recognize that humans can pass the virus from one person to another, that there's a heightened need for vigilance and alert. So I would say our posture right now is keeping a close eye on this spread and recognize that in the animal population, it's clear that this virus is spreading quite rapidly. And in those that work very closely in industries with either cattle or, you know, with birds, have the potential for getting that virus. And it looks like, at least in the recent cases, that perhaps a person who does have an active case could pass that to another human being, probably in transmission of, you know, the droplets or mucosal type of fluids.
Yeah. You know, the one thing I will add is we don't have any evidence to date of human-to-human transmission of H5N1, which is great. We don't know enough about this most recent case. We know that this virus is epizootic. It's in epidemic proportions in birds, but it's also affecting other wild animals. And it could be possible, I don't know, it could be possible that this person was exposed through some sort of a wild animal that they came into contact with. Maybe they were a hunter or something like that, where they potentially got exposed that way.
And my last question is, normally we think of fall as the time of, you know, increases in viruses and bacteria, but But the summer that just ended saw a spike in COVID cases because of excessive heat in some parts of the country and world. People were in congregating inside to stay out of the heat. How does this newer climate change-driven problem affect the thinking that goes into both vaccine production and mutations of the virus? If people are in closer proximity for many more months during the year, does that make it more likely that viruses will mutate faster?
That is a really good question. Anytime you have people congregating in close settings, you're going to see an increased risk of, you know, infectious diseases transmitting. The reason why we have seasonal patterns for influenza and RSV is in part because people tend to be in closer proximity during the winter months. If that starts happening more in the summer months where people want to be in an enclosed and air-conditioned space, we might start to see increased, respiratory virus transmission occurring.
Sarah?
I just wanted to add, I think we're still not totally sure what patterns will look like for COVID. And that's been a challenge. I think we want to align with flu, but we've seen that it may not. So I think we're still learning a lot about these diseases, even though some of them have been around for quite a while. COVID is a little newer, but we're still learning about what patterns look like and how to best protect against it.
And what are you recommending to people, especially folks who may have compromised health? As we move into fall, should people consider wearing masks when they're in public again? I just flew to Fairbanks, and I was one of three people on the plane with a mask. I don't think I'll ever fly again without a mask, but I know that not everyone wants to wear one. What are you suggesting, or what is the CDC saying these days?
Yeah, it's actually a great question. CDC has put out a very helpful snapshot, which is available online. It talks about two different strategies, one layer of strategies they just call the core prevention strategies. And this is what we should all be considering and doing. That's being immunized, practicing good hygiene, taking steps for cleaner air inside and making sure there's good ventilation, seeking treatment if we get sick, and of course, staying home and separate from others if we are ill. They call those core strategies. But separate for that, for the people that you're talking about, those who are immunocompromised, those who are in at-risk age groups, they add this layer they call the additional prevention strategies. And basically, there's three. They say masking, keeping distance, especially during periods of known circulation, and then third is running tests. And so it's just a reminder that really, as we go into this season, the equipment that we have to really make a difference are one, vaccination. Two, if you're sick, seek testing and treatment. And three, continue to practice these core strategies. And if you're in a higher risk group, consider adding the enhanced strategies as well.
Thank you so much. We will link to those guidelines on our website with the Talk of Alaska post. Thank you so much to our guest today, Dr. Robert Lawrence, the Chief Medical Officer for the State of Alaska, Dr. Joe McLaughlin, State Epidemiologist with the Alaska Department of Health, and Sarah Aho, the Immunization Program Manager for the Alaska Health Department. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and Ava White helped us out on the phones today. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.